let's define the PDF. Imagine that you've got an ensemble of velocity fields, with one realization of a velocity field. You've got an ensemble of these velocity fields, and you're defining a probability density function, which depends on the separation between two points, which to make it look something more general, velocity difference between the two points and time. By picking out the members of the ensemble which have the difference in velocity with the specified value, and say put it into a delta function here and take the ensemble average of all that. But they, I'll use this notation. U1 is the velocity of the point x1, and U2 is the velocity of the point x2, or x2 is just x1 plus rho, the difference in position. That's the rho that's here. And if you've got, if it's homogeneous, did I spell that right?
This one.
Yes.
As long as that's, I always get it wrong, so I figured.
It sort of looks like homogeneous, but that's okay.
Anyway, you're independent of x1, it's homogeneous. That is, you can shift your two points anywhere and do the ensemble average, and you get the same result. It's independent of x1. And if it's isotropic, then it's only going to depend on the, it's independent of rotation, so it only depends on the magnitude of rho, the magnitude of b, and the dot product of the two. So that would only depend on three variables there instead of six, like this. Or you can write it as the separation distance, rho is not density here. Rho is the separation distance, and the b parallel is the velocity difference in the direction of vector rho, and b perp is the velocity component perpendicular to that. So it only depends on those three variables in time. And you get an exact equation for F this way. If you take that formal definition there, take this delta function and just differentiate this function with respect to time. The time is in U2 and U1, so you differentiate with respect to time. And just using the chain rule, so you take the derivative, maybe you don't like to take the derivative of the delta function, but you're taking the derivative of this thing with respect to time. Time is in U2 and U1, so you take the derivative of the function with respect to its argument, which is B, and then take the derivative of the argument with respect to time. So you get the time derivative coming here. You've got this ensemble average to do on that. And then you substitute for the time derivative from the Navier-Stokes equation. Okay, so I called the right-hand side of the Navier-Stokes equation A temporarily. The acceleration, but two parts, the gradient of the pressure and the square of the velocity part. And solve for du dt, and you plug that in there, and you manipulate that around, and you can get this exact equation. It says that it looks like Bolt's equation, so where F is a PDF of the velocity field, and then you have B dot gradient, the dd rho is a gradient in position space, and the dv is the gradient in velocity space, because you've got all these two different variables. You have to have two times a gradient operator, so I use that notation, which is common notation from kinetic theory. Okay, so you've got a convection operator here, and the divergence in velocity space of something, which is the difference in acceleration of the two points, average. Okay, now how's it, that's exact. It requires that the divergence of velocity be zero, and that it be homogeneous. It doesn't have to be isotropic at this stage. And you can write that as, like this. Just redefine this thing by dividing by F. Put F off here, so F equals F. For that quantity, FB is it's a conditional average of the the difference in acceleration at 2 points on the, with the, with the condition that the velocity is different. So a conditional expectation. And, okay, now there are lots of different ways. What I want to do is close this equation. And I'll do it, there are lots of different ways to do it. But what I'll do is, I'll close it by assuming something for that function there. Of course, if you put the right function in there, then it would be exact. But the problem with closure is it's not exact, and therefore you don't satisfy the original Navier-Stokes equations anymore. Exactly. So this closure that I'll propose may give nonsense. And that's what I call a blind closure, anyway. It's got no physics involved with it. It's got no vortex dynamics. It's got nothing that you can. I don't think I like that too well. What do we do to stop this from falling around?
Move it to the other side.
Let it flow. Okay.
You want to be on the windows?
Let it flow. It's only the paper that blows, the Eucrats don't blow. So this is my idea, this whole idea, is to close the equation by assuming something for FD. That is, let that be something that only depends on F, on the PDF itself, and then you've only one variable in the equation, I mean one unknown, the PDF itself. And why would I want to do it that way? There are lots of ways you could think of trying to close the equation. Because that equation, when you close it that way, becomes formally a first-order partial differential equation, which you can solve by integrating along the characteristics. The characteristics are, well, okay. The rho dt is v, and the d dt is fv, so it's like particle trajectories, where that fv is the conditional acceleration difference between the 2 points. So it looks like you're doing particle dynamics in some way. Then you've got an equation for F, where this is the divergence in velocity space of that function FV. Okay? And the reason for doing it this way is that PDFs have got to be positive. You close the way I propose, it'll always be positive. If you integrate along the characteristics, integrate this equation along the characteristics, you get exponential of that function integrated on time, which is always a positive quantity. So the idea is you start at some point. This is my configuration space here. You start at some point. This point is the first particle position, and this point is the second particle position at the time that you want the solution. And you specify a b. So you specify a rho and a b, and you integrate these equations backward in time. So it's like saying I'm looking at that one particle moving relative to another along some trajectory. I go backward in time until I intersect the initial time or the boundary here. Or if you look at it with the time variable, right, as a cylinder. So there's time, and this is space in the top direction. And here are my two row and b. So for each row and b, I have to integrate those particle trajectories backwards until they intersect the side boundary or the bottom boundary. Bottom boundary is the initial time.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Maybe I missed something, but yeah. If the flow is incompressible,
yeah.
Why isn't F constant on trajectories?
In other words, well, I suppose what I'm asking is, what is the actual content?
This is not zero, you see, because this is the divergence in velocity space.
Uh-huh.
I've got six variables. Three position variables and three velocity variables, like you put to the Boltzmann equation.
Right, but I mean, in why isn't the total phase space divergence zero? Or am I?
It's not.
Okay.
You see, then with the Boltzmann equation, you've got a right-hand side, and then you've got sort of an extra force here, and that usually is divergence-free in velocity space.
Okay.
Right, but that's not the case here.
Okay.
And in fact, I've got a, I haven't told you what I'm going to assume, or, but it won't be
useful to see what's in the excess.
Because anyway, this is sort of a mathematical problem. Once I decide how to do that, then I've got to solve the equations by integrating along the trajectories of these particle paths. And I need initial conditions and perhaps boundary conditions.
And now, is this, I mean, without closure, so far there is no closure, there is no F capital. This system of three equations, is it mathematically equivalent to the equation for probability distributions that you wrote in the previous?
Let me put that.
Actually, you asked about probability distribution earlier, and now you have some kind of a Lagrangian. Is this equivalent to the system of three equations?
Yeah, well, the rho dt is v. The v dt, I differentiate this out. So you get a fv times partial f with respect to v. That's the v dt equals f part. And then you get the additional part that comes from the divergence in velocity space of fv times f.
This equation formally, I just want to understand the basics. In this equation formally, f small is the probability of having this v and that rho. And as far as there is v and rho, they aren't function of time, they're just variables in the probability distribution.
Yes.
Now you are saying, this is probability distribution is unsteady, somehow it changed with time.
Yeah.
Now you're saying that you can model this variation of your probability distribution with time by making v and rho time dependent.
No, what I'm saying is not. It's just a mathematical step. Anytime you've got a first order partial differential equation, you can replace it by a system of characteristic equations. Right.
It's like going from the top to the
characteristics specified to the.
So actually you solve this equation by characteristics.
Yeah.
And in this terms, those three equations are formally equivalent to this equation.
Yes,
without
exactly.
Making any closure.
Exactly.
No, I don't think it's right. So because you assumed on the way that fm depends on f small.
Yeah, well.
Whatever
that
is, it
depends
on how you get the
quantity
equation.
That fv depends on
f, right?
Because that function is not known without knowing f. So I've got a formal way of solving this, but it ends up with an integral
question.
Yeah.
So I show that this kind of ansatz, which you are going to apply, that f is a function of v only, will support incompressibility.
Yeah.
So you can.
I built that in. Well, once you make the closure, then you may not. You may not have incompressibility because you don't completely satisfy the Navier-Stokes equation anymore. But
there are some things that you would like.
Yeah, you're right. I would like, and I'm not sure.
So you're giving up incompressibility?
I'm giving up the completely satisfying the Navier-Stokes equation. Once you close something, you don't do it. You know. Well, the question is what I'm going to propose anything that's sensible? I mean, maybe it's not sensible. What I propose to do to close this is about almost the only thing you can do. I'm going to assume that. That FB can be closed by assuming joint normal statistics for three particle, three velocity PDF. But let me explain what that is. When I put in that the acceleration is the sum of the pressure gradient and the gradient U, then the PDX, the gradient of the pressure, is a function, the functional of the velocity from the pressure Poisson equation, taking the divergence from the Navier-Stokes equation. So pressure gradient is given as a function of the velocity field in one realization, where I'm using U3 as the integration variable here. U3 is U of step X3 and X3 here. So that's just a solution of the Poisson equation. And then where I've got the terms with acceleration times that delta function, I'll have the pressure gradient times that delta function. And you can see that this depends on the velocities at three points, the U3 and the U1 and the U2. And there's some machinery that goes on here in order to work out what that function should be. I'll assume that the three-point statistics are joint normal, which can be written this way, if you can accept this kind of a Greek notation. This is a three-point PDF, depending on velocity V1, V2, V3, and the positions X1, X2, X3. And it's given, the most convenient way to do it is to represent in terms of its Fourier transform. The P's are the Fourier transforms of velocities. And the P3 can be expressed in the usual Gaussian way as quadratic functions of P's and the correlation function. The correlation function is the expectation of the velocity at xj minus the expectation of the velocity at xj times the velocity at xi at 2 points. There's certain machinery that goes on here. For instance, when I take the expectation of this thing, imagine that you put the PDF, this PDF's in here, and I take the expectation. And I can write this as minus 1 over 4 pi, that integral of partial respect to x3, partial respect to x3, over the absolute value of x. Minus x3. Take the expectation inside, so I get double dot here, and U3 delta of V minus U2 minus U1. Okay? And then integrate that the whole thing with respect to VX3, which you can't see anymore, but. Okay, but the thing is, I've taken the expectation inside, and this quantity can be written, that expectation can be written as the integral of V3 delta, so V is fixed here, minus V2 minus V1 times this PDF, times F3. And let me write it in a different notation. It depends on V1, V2, V3. And I'm integrating that, okay, on DV. Okay, F times V1, V2, V3. Okay, so then you put in what the F3 is in terms of its characteristic function. You do that written there. There's a bunch of manipulation symbols around, and you carry that out, and you see the result will depend on this correlation function. So this is just to indicate the machinery that's involved. It took me months to do that.
So here we have Navier's scope and incompressibility at this point.
In this point, it's built into the correlation function. Okay, now, here. That's what the correlation function is. It's an expectation of velocity product of two points, a tensor quantity. Two arrows to me is Rij. which, now, if I restrict now to homogeneous and isotropic differences, I didn't have to have that before. This function only depends on the distance between the two points and the unit vector in the direction of the two points. The hat there is a unit vector that you make out of the vector both. And the U squared is the, I'll call the energy. It's the average of the square of the velocity in one direction. It's isotropic, so it doesn't make any difference which direction. And this function we have to specify. This method doesn't determine what the velocity, what this energy is. And the dissipation is the is the derivative of the energy. So there's a minus 3 half v u squared dt. So this function of time is given, and therefore its derivative is given. And let's see. The representation of this, which satisfies the divergence of the velocity and so on, is in terms of a function of rho times the identity tensor, the time plus another function of rho times rho half. That is, this is the isotropic homogeneous form that you get from the correlation function, where those two functions A and B depend on the longitudinal correlation coefficient, which is called various things. I'm calling it H, which looks like this. It's a function that drops off like rho to the 2/3 power approximately. It goes to zero, or maybe it goes even negative before it goes back up again. There are two length scales involved there. One of them is determined by the dissipation epsilon. It's the essentially the curvature of this thing, this top here. If you fit a parabola to that, to the top of that curve and go down on it until you intercept the zero axis, that length is the Taylor microscale. And another length is the scale of the whole thing is u cubed over epsilon. Usually you have epsilon is u cubed over L over some length. I'm defining the length to be epsilon over the length to be u cubed over epsilon. So that u cubed over epsilon is the length scale of this problem.
It's an outer scale. It's an outer scale.
That's an outer scale, and this would be an inner scale. Okay. So what you see is the function fb that I'm trying to get a hold of is going to depend it's going to depend only on h. It only depends on this one scale or function in time and u squared. Okay. So, but the problem is that I don't know h. So that means that what I'm doing here is trying to solve an integral equation. Well, first of all, this is what the function fd looks like. You can do all that machinery that I described to put in those functions. Okay. The function of h, all these PLL and all these things depend on h. But it depends on velocity in two places. Here's the B was my original velocity. Here's B dot rho and the transverse velocity squared. So B dot rho squared and B per squared, I guess you could call that. It's only quadratic in the velocity. This part comes from the pressure term, pressure gradient term. And this part comes from the viscous term. The part that depends on the viscous term is linear in the velocities. But two components, but component parallel and perpendicular to rho. And you see the epsilon coming here. The epsilon comes because in the process you have to calculate the del squared of that correlation function at zero separation. And that turns out to be the dissipation function. Okay. And the BLL are structure function, the BNN are structure function, the average of the velocity difference squared in the direction along the separation of the two particles, or maybe more easily, it's this average that you calculate from the PDF function. It's the second moment of the PDF function. the second moment of the component, the long direction of the I've got essentially cylindrical coordinates here. I've got the component, this function depends on the component in the direction of rho and the component perpendicular. So you could write this as 2 pi f, see, b parallel. I don't like that notation, I use 1 and 2. And the BMN is the velocity in the direction perpendicular to the separation of the two particles. But these are just functions of H. The DLL, in terms of the functions A and B I defined before, they're just functions of A and B. In fact, DLL is, if you have this H function looking like this, something like that, then the quantity that the BLL is the 1 minus H. This is 1 here, so the 1 minus H is this part, times 2. So it's a function that looks like this, and it's this part turned over, so it goes up like this. Something like that, experimentally it looks like that. This is what the BLL looks like. This is the second moment.
And now what you've confined, you've restricted yourself to isotropic flow. Right?
Now I'm restricted to isotropic and homogeneous. I can think of a more general kind of
problem. I
don't
think that
can go negative.
Well,
I looked at
the transverse lambdas, but that's very critical.
There's a paper I just got out of Van Atta and Chen. And he has it going a little bit negative.
That's the
this is not the transverse one, it's the longitudinal correlation coefficient. Actually, he had it going negative too. It's a question of what it should be, because he had it for going negative for grid flow turbulence.
I think you can show theoretically it can't go negative. Mm-hmm. I think that's an artifact of the
no, it's just a factor which has to be positive. That it can go negative.
You think it has
physical space?
Denikos and Lumley gives longitudinal and transverse, so there you can see that.
In the measurements, it probably does
stay positive.
Longitudinal remains positive, but transverse by quantity equation can be negative.
Yeah, but in the measurements, you have this
but
problem.
But is that critical for your
experiment?
It's
bounded.
No, it's not critical.
I don't think it's a very small thing.
But in fact, I always just taken it to be something that goes down like that. That's all.
That's good to know.
But I was just looking yesterday at the paper by Dan Adam and Ken, and they had measurements. And I don't see too much.
But that's the stream-wise velocity, probably separating
but
remember, Tom, that's an experiment. It's not homogeneous. It's decaying in the downstream direction.
That's right.
And it's also high pass.
So
it creates this problem.
Okay. But anyway, fortunately, not much of what I'm looking at depends on it. But I'm glad you pointed that out because I'm a little bit unsure what to do there. Okay. But now the problem is, this is an integral equation. I don't know H. That means I have to construct this function FB, put it into the first order differential equations. I mean, in order to do that, I've got to assume a function form for H. Then I've got to solve the equations and calculate the second moment, the DLL, which is the integral of rho f squared of f. Okay. So I've got to assume the function H, which is this, compute the BLL, and maybe I have to iterate, because it's not going to come out to be exactly what you put in. And so far what I'm doing is just probing at these equations. And what I'm doing is putting in functions for H and seeing what I can compute out of it. And I can imagine iterating on it. I'm doing this on my laptop at home, and if I had a bigger computer, maybe I could do more. But it's interesting that I can do it on the laptop even.
even for age, you have to assume two things, such as lambda and the integral time scale, then more or less you are home free. So that's easier than
two scales. Now this first part is dependent on the pressure. It's got these complicated functions of h and the functions of h in there, and this is an integral, a functional of h. These depend on the bulk of h, but this one is actually a hard integral, which I've also done. Well, the point is that this pressure gradient part is quadratic in the velocity, and the viscous parts are linear in the velocity. And there's a little support for that. Toshi Goto, who gave a talk here a couple of months ago.
You say little or a little? You say little support.
Gave some support.
A little support.
Okay. A little, yes. I took this off the web and enlarged it in the data view graph. This thing is this first one is this computation done with isotropic homogeneous turbulence. I don't remember what the mesh spacing was. That's the number of grid points, but it's the difference in the pressure gradient conditioned on the difference in velocity. I'm not sure which components to use. Maybe average over all components. But the thing is that this is the result. You see, this is essentially quadratic in the velocity of the body versus the velocity. So it's essentially quadratic in the velocity. And there's lots of stuff on there. It's of course, different separation. You can't make it out, but it's for different separations, all the different curves here. But there's sort of a common part that looks like it's quadratic. And then this lower one was the difference in del squared of the velocity, condition on the velocity difference being given. And it's essentially linear here. See, this goes from minus 5 to 5. This is velocity divided by RMS velocity. And that's pretty far out. So it's essentially linear here. It looks like it's linear in a larger scale, too.
It doesn't look like cubic because it's sort of because it's
zero. Say again?
Yeah, because the zero derivative is zero. It sort of look like cubic.
You would say that's zero. I didn't like that. In a way, it looks better to look at this as linear, but I'm not sure. And it's for different separations. So I didn't like that too much. But then I was talking to Kaneda, who had done something similar that he thought was similar anyway. And he said, well, this is, mine is better. But it's not the same. That's the problem. See, he's got the LAP is del squared of the velocity, but it's not the difference in del squared of velocity. This U11 is the derivative of U1 with respect to X1. So this is the velocity gradient, and I'm plotting it versus the velocity gradient. It's not exactly the same as looking at velocity differences, but nevertheless, it's linear, essentially, in that variable. I don't see that as a great amount of support, but it's not quite the same thing, but it's something similar. Okay, now.
It's not the same thing because.
No. Well, it would if you multiplied the top and the bottom by a delta.
It might look like this, and then you can approximate
by gradient. That's right.
I debated
whether to even show that, but it doesn't really support it too much. Now, for initial conditions and boundary conditions, what I've done is when I integrate in the first things I've been doing, I've been integrating backward in time, doing that thing, figuring until I get this boundary out here, which is order one. Let's see, but I've made things dimensionless with that variable capital L. So when the separation is on the order of the integral scale, if I intersect that boundary at that time, I take the PDF to be independent at a step like this. As that means that if you're integrating backward, that means if you would start from here, the particles coming from being separated, and probably the PDF is independent, like you would do for the Boltzmann equation. And as you come forward, they become correlated. So in the things I've done, I've assumed usually that the F at the boundary is given by this thing at the exit point, where that velocity there is that energy there is the energy at the earlier time when you hit the boundary. So it depends on the past history of the energy, time dependent term. And if went backward in time, I hit the initial time, which I can change. Before I hit that boundary, I still didn't be independent. There's other things you could do there, but I'm probing that way. Okay, so now, in doing this, this is the part that Bill George is interested in. I could introduce similarity variables. In fact, as a matter of course, I've made things dimensionless by letting capital B be that little b divided by that u, which is the RMS velocity at one point. And I've let that little r be the separation distance divided by L, where L is defined by the dissipation function. And I've introduced a time, which is the integration from 0 to t of the epsilon, which is the u squared t, it's a dimensionless thing. Essentially, t is the log of the energy. And I've called f tilde u cubed times f, so that it's the integral in these variables would be 1 if it was in the other variables. And in the equations, I didn't want to write them all down again, but they look like this. They've got two parameters that only depend on time. Okay, I've got the FPT. This function comes time, so times the derivative with respect to R, and I've got this F, it's a shorthand notion for the FB and the two variables. And the G, I didn't want to write them down again, but there's time occurring in these equations, and only two parameters, T, which is the time derivative of the log of epsilon over u cubed, and a Reynolds number based on that integral scale, L, and u. Now, if you put in a power law or exponential in time for u, in particular, this is what I use mainly, it's just a constant. Okay. This quantity is a constant for any power. I didn't write down what the constant is, but it depends on n. And this one, the Reynolds number, would be constant only if n is equal to 1. So that would make this would be a case where the Reynolds number would be independent of time because L increases like t to the half and u decreases like t to the minus a half. That would be the case. So most of the things I'll show you are done with infinite Reynolds number. And then I take the n to be like 1.2, which is what experiments give pretty close.
You know of infinite Reynolds number experiments?
Do I know one? No. No, I don't.
Okay.
If you have one, I'll look at it.
That's not like the n equals 1 is exactly what I think the infinite Reynolds number limit is.
I know. And that's what I'm not assuming that I've got a similar. But in fact, whenever I have to assume something for u, I've always got the p equal constant, and I've neglected the Reynolds number. So while I haven't assumed a similarity solution, to start from some time, and it should tend to a similarity solution. That's what usually happens with similarity solutions, but maybe not. So I've carried this out, and I've probed it by putting in certain functions. And I get things, I get something that looks like this. Now this is, it's not exactly what you'd want, but I've got Reynolds number infinity, and I put in H equal 1 minus A up R to the 2/3, which looks like that, and then I cut it off then. And I've taken A to be 1.1. The A equal 1, and this I've done by adjusting A. So there's where I'm doing the integral equation. I'm putting that in, and I ran it a few times to so that I get the BLL to come out the same as the H.
Isn't the power of R should be 2?
Excuse me?
It should be like a parallelogram, small r, right? H.
Yeah, this looks like R to 2/3.
Yeah, but when R is small, to fit the oscillating parabola, you have to have...
Yeah, no, but I've got infinite Reynolds number, so I don't have it. It just comes up sharp there.
Okay.
And I draw it in the next term, except the epsilon. Anyway, with A 1.1, the energy spectrum is constant times epsilon 2/3 k to minus 5/3. This constant is the three-dimensional Hilbert spectral constant. C is approximately 1.5 times k. That is, the A there determines the spectral constant C. With A equal 1.1, the C is like 1.65, which is about what's observed. Okay, now, what I'm plotting here is the component of the velocity along the direction of rho, which means I have to integrate out the other variable, the other component. I solve this 3D, and then I have to integrate out the other variable. And you notice an awful-looking spike here. In fact, it's singular. When I have infinite Reynolds number, it's singular at zero velocity. I'll discuss that a little more. But look at does that result make any general sense? Well, if you look at experiments like this one, see, you've got something that's rather pointed at the middle, and it drops off, and it's got these exponential tails. It maybe looks quite different to you here, but you'll notice that whereas this one comes down at 10, it comes down to 10 to the minus 6 or so. At 10, I've got a couple of them at 10 to the minus 6. When I take the separation, these are separations small and getting bigger. And as I go down with these, this is the biggest separation. It's about 0.1. This is getting closer to Gaussian. If I put in 0.5, I get something that really is very close to Gaussian. And even anything greater than that is very, very close to Gaussian.
What I would say is that your spike in the middle is the whole thing for the Prescosti and Onclay. And what you have in the wings is would be off in their noise where they wouldn't be able to measure. So,
well,
but I don't think they ever get a spike. Have you seen?
No. That's something the matter there. I'll show you what the problem is. There's something the matter there, but the spikiness is actually physically important. I mean, if that were true, this is saying something very strong about intermittency. It's saying that overwhelmingly. If you look at a turbulent field, it would overwhelmingly have zero difference in velocity if it's really spiky like that. That means that because the part that doesn't have zero velocity, which has rapid oscillations, would be a small part of the field. So the spikiness is, it says that zero velocity is much more likely than if you have a normal.
What are the R values there? Is comparable?
I'm plotting the same thing.
No, I know, but you have some parameter.
Roughly. Yeah. See, I kept thinking, trying to make this smaller and smaller. because I was trying to get it to curve up like this, and I could never get it to curve up. I could get it to get, go out this way, but I could never get it to curve upward.
But spike at R approaching zero also makes sense, so I feel like you're just
something
local originally. Yeah, locally there.
And what it happens that way because it depends on initial conditions, and what I'm showing you, I've put the initial conditions back so far that it always hits the side boundary first. So it doesn't depend on the initial conditions.
Okay. There's a lot of decaying turbulence, right?
Yeah, what?
The experiment was not decaying turbulence, was it? It was...
It's stationary turbulence.
It's stationary.
Yeah. That was very turbulent.
Yeah.
It wasn't an experiment.
So yeah, are these fully converged? You've iterated many times? Or?
Well... that's yet to be known, but it's essentially giving something that, essentially, you see, what I've got is like this. Forget about the, I've got infinite Reynolds number, so the thing I'm trying to hit looks like this. Like that. Okay. Where this is about one.
What are you plotting there?
I'm plotting BLL.
Okay.
That's
I got it.
And I'm getting agreement with what I put in for numbers out to 0.1. So I've got 3 points very close down in here that agree with that.
What happens after that?
And if I put, I just tried one yesterday, if I put in 0.5, I get something up in here, and I put in one, I get something up in here. So I'm close to having some kind of a solution of the integral equation, but the spike is bothersome, and that bothered me for a long, long time.
Is it the amplitude of this point grows as you decrease R?
Does what grow?
The way you use the amplitude of this point grows when you decrease R?
Yeah, A is normalized, it should grow.
Oh no, it may give you a negligible confusion.
But so say again, what grows as I make R? Yeah.
It's like C.
Okay, this is, okay. What I've done is, I found that what happens is simply this. It then depends on the initial conditions. If you look at this picture that I've been drawing, if you look at a small separation and put in a very small velocity, then it takes a long time for it to reach the boundary. And in fact, when you work the trajectory back, it hits the boundary back here somewhere. If I make the boundary, the initial condition farther and farther back in time, then I'll hit the sidewall before I hit that. So I put in rather smallish initial conditions. This is minus 0.2 back with the new time variable I've got. That's this one. As I increase the, as I make the time further and further back, the spike gets bigger and bigger. And this last one is the one that's infinite. Okay. Also, I find if I put viscosity in, it doesn't become infinite too. So either way, I can get rid of that singularity. But it still wants to look a little spiky when you look at it this way. Okay, let's see, what else was I going to say here? Now here's one, just one case with a small r with finite Reynolds number, it's still kind of spiky. With the Reynolds number of 50,000, r lambda is 866, and eta over L, the Kolmogorov constant over L is 0.0.
You're generating velocities with some sort of iteration procedure?
I've only been adjusting that constant A so far.
But you have an iteration procedure.
I will. I will. But, you know, this is all taking a lot of time.
Well, so yeah. All you have now is scaling theory?
No.
No.
No, I'm computing.
You're computing.
I'm computing. But I put in an initial H. It looks like this, and then I iterate the BLL from the result that I get.
It's a correlation function.
It's just a correlation function.
Yeah. So,
but you're getting distributions out of a correlation function.
Well, I solve those difference equations, and I get functions for.
Fine.
And in fact, when I show you something like this, I've integrated out the other variable, the transverse velocity component, which looks like somewhere here we've got that. I mean, I don't think people even measure this one. This is again for the infinite Reynolds number case, but it's the PDF versus you follow what I'm talking about. The thing that's the transverse component of the velocity scale with r to the 1/3 here. For large separation, you see. For large separations, the minus 10 and the plus 10 are here. So the minus 10 is a little bit higher than the plus 10. And now as you go down to small separation, it gets bigger and bigger. And at zero, it's actually going up faster than, it's so fast it's not integrable. That's what the problem. That's why I got the infinite values. This is going up faster than the first problem. So in order to get anything I've shown you there, I have to integrate over functions that look like this. I do the three-dimensional problem, which is really axially symmetric in velocity space, and integrate off over the transverse velocities. I think that's anything else here. No. So that's probably long enough.
Okay. Let me get this straight. The PDF goes high at zero, smaller and smaller separation.
Yeah.
Why is this surprising, I don't understand. I think that's what you'd expect.
Yeah.
2 point must move.
That spike, but you wouldn't want to go infinite there. The ones I've shown you were infinite.
Yeah,
so
they're infinite. Yeah. Number you would not.
So I put in finite velocity or finite time in the past, I get finite results. Yeah.
You would get a cusp, that's what I'm trying to say. I mean, that's not surprising.
Well, it looks cuspy.
As you progressively approach, the velocity difference should be.
These look kind of
sharp. Measurements at extremely small separation, I don't know. Yeah. Is this time shifted or this is two probes? Two probes will have probably interference and all kinds of things go on when it gets so small.
If you're right in interpreting that as being entirely due to the initial conditions, then these guys would see that because presumably that's close stationary.
That's right. But it also smooths off because of viscosity, which means that they think the results don't depend on viscosity. They've made the separation distance large compared to.
I think near zero is virtually impossible to take data. So I see.
How do you interpret that?
I interpret it as meaning something, saying something very strong about intermittency. I mean, Gaussian would look like this. You wouldn't have this big a spike here. So this is saying that it's more likely than Gaussian that the difference in velocity is zero.
When you look over the field of the velocity.
And how do you relate that to the initial condition? The inference would be that.
But for small velocities, it takes it a long time to reach the side boundary. And in fact, it'll hit the bottom initial time. First, you have finite initial time.
I have a question. Yes, it's a small question. I mean, there are a couple of constraints. I think it would be nice to see that your closure satisfies before you start interpreting results.
Yes.
For example, the four-fifths law.
The four-fifths law was satisfied for the D.
It is satisfied.
Yes, I could calculate third moments from that. Yes, and I got that. That came out fine. Yes. But to try to get fourth and fifth moments, or try to do anything about. In fact, I doubt that I have a lot of doubts about what the experiments do, even because if you go out this far, you can't really calculate. If you take this thing and multiply it by the fourth power, I get the third moment, but the fourth moment not too well. And so I wonder if anybody,
the measurements to share what they're getting.
No, they have longer of this data, like Frank Yu and Klebanov, those data, they have 18 more measurements.
Right.
But they do check that.
So the integrant. Who has that?
Klebanov. There's a
way back.
40 years,
I think.
Yes.
Way back. Yeah, but they quit at 8.
Well, they have gone pretty high.
I think they got to the hypercritosis, something like that. At least the 6.
No, they have more than that.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. But the problem is you're just basically limited by your bandwidth of your instrumentation,
yeah.
The slewing rates.
And
I haven't seen anybody since Wenger.
The main reason is things happen very infrequently. So you have to have many of the data.
Oh, yeah.
You have to take data for hours.
That's true.
That's the other
thing. And stuff like this, you're limited by numerics because, I can go out further than 10, I can go out 20, but I'm starting to get numerical problems out there.
Would you say something about the decay law?
I have to assume the decay law, and the results don't seem very sensitive to what that N is. You know, that I was hoping long ago that by adjusting N, I could satisfy some integral, some of the things I wanted to satisfy. But no,
your results are, it seems like determined by the correlation function.
And
I don't think the decay law will severely affect the correlation.
Yeah, that's right. And so there's no way that I could see, since it didn't even have a very big effect. I mean, I put in n equal 1.2 or n equal 1 or n equal 1.4, it doesn't change anything.
I'm sorry, is it true that they are determined by correlation functions only?
By what?
By correlation functions only. I thought you assumed the whole what about three-point distribution function.
Well, that's for any U squared.
What is the input? Is the correlation function, right?
Not all. It's a closure. You put something in the equation.
Given the closure, the only input is correlation.
If you want to compare to the experiment, then you have to take all the
information. That's in the nature of all.
So I put in the essentially experimental value for U squared, and I don't have a way to figure out what it should be. It doesn't seem to affect the results, so it doesn't matter very much.
By the way, I think Zen Susher and others have had all this PDF. Have you plotted their strengths?
Who?
Che. And a whole bunch of people.
Oh, they have PDF. So they're looking at. Well, they were looking at anomalous scaling.
No, but that implies something. It implies log Poisson or something for the PDF. But
such plots are available. I've seen many papers.
I'm just barely getting into the equations now, so I don't have a response requirement. So there's probably a lot more to do.
You showed the result from Goto about the pressure correlation, and you were very happy that it was a parabola. Why were you happy?
Well, that's quadratic in Watson.
Oh, I see.
Only that. Maybe it doesn't have the right
Can I ask about the internal consistency? So you assume something about H, right? H is an input.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's a two-point function.
Yeah.
Your result is a CDF difference using which you can compute the two-point function again.
That's right.
So we get...
that's what I'm computing, yes.
Yeah.
That's why I thought this...
That's his iteration.
The H is this. Yes. And the B is essentially this part. You see. So I put in the H and I compute the B.
Yes.
And I've got points along this line. So this B I could put in from the function I picked.
Presumably you could do 5 Reynolds numbers.
I'm starting to do that. What I'm doing is putting a little bit of a curvature in there. I'm getting there. What Bill Jordan would like me to do is to put in a finite Reynolds number, in which case, and n equal 1, which I can do.
Well, make it, and if you're going to do a finite Reynolds number, make n different than 1. Right?
Well, you would want N equal 1, and...
No, what is the infinite rules on the limit? I would argue N is bigger than minus, or less than minus 1. But what if my...
The infinite Reynolds number, incidentally, didn't, the second moment didn't matter that it went infinite, because I multiplied by 5.
While you're playing around with it, what my simple, if you basically took my single length scale, it turned out, I was looking at it, your time ends up just being time. So it probably would simplify the equation somewhat. And remember, the integral scale is proportional to the microscale. So
they're all simplified equations. If you take a Reynolds number based on L, then the Taylor microscale to L depends on the power of the Reynolds number.
Right.
The Kolmogorov length over the L depends on the power of the Reynolds number. So they're all proportional to each other.
So I think the dependence on initial conditions is intriguing.
Oh yes, in the infinite case. But suppose you look for the similarity solution for N equal 1. Then you get some shape, and it's consistent with everything you've said. I mean, if there is a similarity solution, it looks like there would be. I mean, for finite Reynolds number. If I can get
the... I bet you could find a similarity solution for your original equation before you even made the closure. That would be interesting.
But that doesn't do anything for you. It just says that, well, you've just got these two length scales, and they're proportional to each other. I mean,
maybe.
That's all it said.
Well, it makes the choice of H simple because you don't have two parameters anymore.
Well, no, it doesn't help. Those two parameters don't bother very much. One comes with the viscous terms and the other doesn't. Right?
Mm-hmm. So, a question in terms, I guess you said you were cutting off your little H at large R where it intersects.
Yeah.
What does that imply for the spectrum? So, what does the spectrum look like?
That's a good question. I don't know.
But you should get, it should be easy to calculate.
I don't know what is the...
I think that's what most people argue gives you the k squared.
I don't know what it does if you let it be cut off like that. I don't know what does something with you here.
Well, it's just the Fourier transform.
It's just the sines kt over, or kx over kx. I think it goes like k squared for small k.
Okay, so that's
also unknown. K squared, kt, k4, all
I think that's what the box
is. I mean, the traditional view says, of course, that there's a relationship between what happens at low k and the decay exponent, but I don't think you'll see that here because... I mean, you're sort of able to put in whatever decay exponent you want, right. So...
Yes. Yeah. Well, so anyway, this is what I'm doing, but...
Is that on each function, supposedly the one that falls off like 1 over r cubed, at large r, for some models?
Say it again? Well, I tried putting in various things. I mean, maybe just to cut it off because it doesn't matter very much. But I could put.
It doesn't matter
because when you get out to a large separation, it wants to go to Gaussian, and then it comes out with the right integral.
Probably can you? I don't think you can really infer the behavior of the correlation function from the invariant, can you? R to the nth times h does not tell you how h behaves for large.
Probably not.
You can get the spectrum with the flow wave numbers, but you can't reverse it, unfortunately.
Yeah, the equation for h, right? If you look at Jordan's books, there must be...
I wouldn't be surprised if it looked anywhere.
Huh?
He's got closure, gives him an edge.
For infinite realms, however, his is perfectly good.
What the H should be at large R, I think, is known from the equation for H.
But regardless, and maybe it would come out that way.
Yeah.
If I can in fact iterate, and if you, remember, you don't have to go back to way back in time. You can do this. You can do this, the time dependent problem and iterate one time step at a time. Right. I mean, you don't have to iterate very much if you just go a short time. That's because so you start with something and you could propagate it out in time and develop whatever H develops.
Okay. Thanks.
I need a bigger computer.
Well, we're joining normal.
That was used in case space a long time ago, right? It's called the quasi normal.
That's Million Chicago.
Yeah. It doesn't work there. But.
No, in fact, I used it once 30 years ago in something too. Yeah.
Thank you.
But this is a different use of it, I guess.
Right.
I guess that's right.
Who could give him credit for a brilliant use of it, but the fact is there aren't any other alternatives, are there?
I don't think anybody has another option.
It's still a lot of work, even if you make
it.
Nobody asked me to do this for my answer. So.
No, I thought the screen was able to tell you.
Yeah, I need to do that. He forgot.
Oh, okay. No, sorry. Okay, you're supposed to.
Are you?
I'll only go one more week before I disappear.
Okay.
They will push together with the audio here, so.
Anyway, that's what I'm doing. That's interesting. I talked to you about three weeks ago.
Yeah,
I was having trouble with the infinite stuff.
Very early on, you're getting jagged.
And then, every day or two, there's some new little bit of your sort of programming.
Yeah.
And adding more things in, trying not to make any mistakes.
You know how to go.
Don't try to do too many things at once.
Okay.
Yeah, it's amazing how much you can get out of that. Because really, the joint normal is the only thing you assume.
That's what.
Yes. Well, no, but well, there is the pressure poison situation.
Yeah, that's right.
I think the same thing. I say two pages of that thing. Which I had to I see the point that if I email it.
Yeah, actually now there is tech which will render any. They have a trip some Dutch person to go with people.
Is this the only closure scheme which yields multi-scaling?
I assume it's good when it is converted to use multi-scaling.
Well, how do you mean
the scale? Well, I mean the way your public distributions.
Yes, right. Do I have anything else I could use?
I don't know the history of closures very well because I'm a new EDQNM, DIA.
Almost everything assumes it's something to do with the antiviscosity. So this is not assuming that.
No, if you assume an antiviscosity now, I think that I would have to referee in fact with some dandy version of Yapper and Norsak, and the claim is that they're getting multi-scaling. But your thing is clearly. Seems to be giving him, it's not converged yet fully, I think.
Yeah, no.
That's okay, I mean, you can do that. Yeah. Why don't you use the computer cap? That would be faster than laptop submit.
Oh, no, actually, I'm using an SP and IBM SP and then source too.
Storage and computation, right?
Yeah, and, right. Actually, my Dell computer.
Yeah.
Consider it. I get up in the night sometimes and run it around.
And I'm saying once you have reliable data in the tails of those distributions, four different bands of R, that immediately implies one scaling exponents.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
I mean, even as the Shellback formula, even though it's a immediately implies log Poisson, if I'm not mistaken, some class of it. Yeah. It's in the class of log Poisson distribution.
Just by seeing the tails.
All the moments are given by the PDF.
Yeah.
If you have PDF with enough accuracy.
Yes. Yes.
Not far enough.
Yeah. But now, see what I do this with the graphics. I take my PDF.
Yeah.
I multiply it by B squared.
Yeah.
So I get something that does that.
No, you're not getting enough resolution.
Yeah. And then the third moment worked out, or I should have mentioned that.
Then you did.
The third moment came, looks like that.
Right.
And it resolves. Yeah. You go to fourth or fifth, then you start. I have to do some really. Maybe double precision arithmetic or something, but that's possible to get more.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That would be important to do. I think it would be important to push this calculation until you've got at least up to a tenth order model.
That's what I see. I see that there are many things that would be interesting to get out of something that you compute with.
I've often thought of closures which would give money getting an eye. I don't know the literature, but EDQNM.
Yes, I remember.
Does that give multi-scaling? Or did people look in those days? See, that's the other thing I'm not quite sure.
Well, there's still people that do that. EDQNM.
Do they get
multi-scaling? I don't think I've seen anything that says they do.
There's one here.
Okay. I think that was an extra.
Okay, fine.
I think
this is really
worth
pushing.
Yeah, well, I've been working on it a year, and I'll keep on doing it.
Nice.
I don't have to get support for anything. I'm retired.
That's what I find very distressing about the U.S. system.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous that people who have, they can't instantly regenerate.
Yeah.
Your intellectual history and neurons.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
That's right, yeah.
And I learned from Fuzzy, he's got a huge amount of equal perception.
Yes, and he's having trouble with
Fuzzy.
Yeah.
There are millions of dollars of equipment, and he can do so many
experiments.
Yeah. And
especially
experiments where you require, postdocs.
Right,
and this country. I mean, that way our system, we all get paid very little.
But you've got plenty of research money, is that
true? No, not research money, but much more about human resources.
Yes, that's right.
Right, I mean the students. Once the student comes in, he or she gets paid the same measly salary.
Yes.
But is that once you get through the interview and the exam or our thing, then the Government of India pays the salary.
Yeah.
And it's not a great salary, but it's still one-fifth of a professor's salary.
Yeah.
And salary is also not great.
Yes.
But that's all seven systems.
Yes, but...
But so far, at least, they haven't sort of forced us to do, very applied things to...
Yeah, I see that the money wants to be in applied things, and it's a...
I think this is worth doing, but this way I'm sure the PDF will be positive. No, that's true. What about interpretability?
No, it's not.
I think it's
cool. But that's the word.